This is Fresh Air. The big winner at the Academy Awards this week was Schindler's List. The movie was adapted from a 1982 book by the Australian writer Thomas Keneally. It's on the bestseller list. In fact, it's on the fiction bestseller list. Keneally says his book is a novel only in the sense that the story is told in novelistic form. The content is true to his research. Fictionalizing the story, he says, would debase the record and make it hard to distinguish between reality and the myths which are likely to attach themselves to a man of Schindler's nature. Oskar Schindler was an opportunistic German businessman who followed the German troops into Poland. He opened a factory and used Jews as slave labor, but he became their protector. He fed them and risked his life time and time again to keep them out of the Nazi death camps. Keneally first heard about Oskar Schindler in 1980 when he was held over in Los Angeles on his way home to Sydney.
Two factors were in my favor. Sydney was not then a glamour destination, so I had a number of days to wait in LA. And secondly, we had a reputation for credit card fraud and it took a long time for the charges on my credit card to be cleared when I went to a Schindler survivor's store, Leopold Pfefferberg's store, and bought a briefcase from him. And in the time it took for my charges to clear, he had found out I was a writer and he began to hit me over the head with the Schindler story in the nicest possible way, and he took me out to the back of the store after the charges had been cleared, and he showed me a collection of Schindleriana, which he had put together for a film which MGM had intended to make on Oscar in the early 1960s. And that was how it began. It began with buying a briefcase and all the contingencies of travel and of being an Australian and having a shonky credit card and all the rest of it.
You mentioned this film that was supposed to be made in 1960. I think Sean Connery was supposed to play the role of Schindler in that.
Yes, or Kurt Jurgens, the German actor, uh-huh. Reese, I think since deceased, who did have a resemblance to Oscar. And the screenplay was written by one of the writers of Casablanca, Howard Koch, and yet it was never produced. I don't know why.
So when you started researching the story of Schindler, you interviewed, I believe, about 50 survivors. Were there a lot of conflicts in their impressions of Schindler and his motivations?
Certainly. There are throughout, I still to this day keep on adjusting my picture of where the line of altruism in Schindler crosses the line of opportunism. Having heard Schindler survivors talk in considerable numbers since the film was made, I sometimes think I may have been a bit hard on Oscar. One of his former prisoners defended him, saying, okay, he was a black marketeer, but black market wasn't what we know it to be. It was an act of revolution. And he's quite right about that. And one hears continual stories of extraordinary gestures of humanity from Oscar to people who were by decree Untermenschen. And yet there are also prisoners who stress the fact that they were slave laborers and they worked well for him, and he made a fortune. And indeed, he did make a fortune. And I'm still as confused as the day I wrote it. But of course, the confusion about motivation as part of the engine that drives that book, if I'd known what drove that man, I swear to God, I wouldn't have been interested in writing it. And that's a shameful confession, that I wouldn't have written a book about a man who was virtuous in a linear way like Roald Wallenberg.
If Schindler is a study in ambiguity, what interested you in the SS officer Armin Goertz, who is portrayed in the film and in your book?
Well, Armin Goertz is part of the equation, because it's from Armin that Oscar got his labor. And it's from Armin, or by Armin's grace, that the heavily bribed grace, let me say, that Oscar was able to put together the camp population of Brinlitz. And the curious thing was they were friends. And the contradictions of that, when you think that Oscar was drinking with Armin, playing practical jokes on him, joshing him. At a stage in early 1943, when Oscar had already been on a secret mission to Budapest to blow the whistle on what the SS were doing in Poland. That's an extraordinary mixture of motivations, the fact that Oscar actually enjoyed drinking with what you could roughly call the devil, that he actually enjoyed the sedition, the working of the system that was inherent in that, and above all, that he might have actually enjoyed Gert's company.
Well, Gert,
that's very interesting.
I mean, this SS officer from your book and the film was a real sadist. One of his hobbies was to sit on his balcony picking off Jews in the camps with a shotgun.
Absolutely, and his behavior in the film is not hyperbole. The transcript of his trial in Krakow in 1946 contains all this information, including that absurdity of his ordering a Jewish engineer, a woman, shot because she gave him advice on the building of a particular barracks block. And after he'd had her shot, saying, "Do what she said." Yes, it's an extraordinary relationship, but I think there is an almost literary quality to the relationship between Oscar and Armin Gert. I believe, though Spielberg, I don't think Spielberg agrees with me, I believe that if the war hadn't happened, that Gert and Oscar would have been roughly the same sort of man. They would have been unsatisfactory husbands. They would have had drinking problems. They would have been commercially faintly unreliable. Gert probably would have been a wife beater. But World War II gave Oscar extraordinary industrial opportunities. It gave him labor that was next to free, and he reacted well morally to that. He reacted better than IG Farben. He reacted better than Krupps, or by factors of you know, incalculably better than any of those. And it also empowered Gert to exercise an imperial power over his prisoners. And he was corrupted by that power, and he became a monster, and he became absurd. That's what I notice about the Holocaust, that it is absurd.
A question that kept occurring to me while I watched the movie of Schindler's List was why, when the Nazis started to realize, as they must have started to realize, that Schindler was protecting the Jews, not just using them as slave labor, why didn't they put him in one of the camps? I mean, I know he was bribing them all, but I'm sure there were some of the SS officers who were ideological enough to, in spite of the bribes, want to do away with somebody who was undermining Nazi values.
I'm sure that's true, but every time he was imprisoned, and he was imprisoned three times during the war, he was released through influence from on high. People who thought he was a good chap, people whom he'd given cognac to, people whom he'd given hams and tea and perhaps a diamond for their wives. I think if the war had gone on much longer, he could have been in trouble, because the prisoners, a remarkable number of the prisoners, mention either in their testimonies in Yad Vashem or in personal interviews that they felt he was sailing close to the wind. They felt a fall was coming, and they feared the fall because it would mean they were sent back to the destruction camps, to the Vernichtungslager. And fortunately, the war ended in time to save him. I don't think he could have kept all those balls in the air much longer.
My guest is Thomas Keneally, author of the 1982 book Schindler's List, which is the basis of the movie of the same name. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Thomas Keneally. I wonder how much you found out about Oscar Schindler and his life after the war, and if after the war how that balance between altruism and opportunism changed, and what was he a permanently changed man?
Yes, certainly. He was something of a marked man. He was once charged with assault for attacking a man who called him a Jew kisser, a man in Frankfurt. He immigrated to Argentina very differently from the Nazi war criminals. He emigrated with some of his former prisoners, and he emigrated on a grant from the Joint Distribution Committee. And he ran a farm in Argentina, in San Vicente, for perhaps 13 years after the war. Then he left Emily, which was a separation which still reverberates in the whole politics of the way we look at Schindler.
This was his wife.
Yes, he dumped his wife and he came to Europe and he was broke. And he was bankrolled by the Joint Distribution Committee again and by former prisoners. And for the Joint Distribution Committee, he wrote a fascinating document, a very long document, explaining what he did for his prisoners and for other Jews in economic terms. And it's much broader than the film has time to show. And on the strength of that, the Joint Distribution Committee bankrolled him. He founded a cement factory in Frankfurt. It went broke. And from that point on, he was dependent on his former prisoners. He received $50,000 from the sale of the movie to MGM in the early 60s. He spent half the year in Frankfurt, half in Israel. By then, his former prisoners were bourgeois people and very successful people, and they thought his drinking was a bit out of control, and his behavior towards women was a bit out of control. And so he would go back to Frankfurt for a bit of low life. And he died in Frankfurt in October 1974. And soon thereafter, his body was translated to Jerusalem, taken to Jerusalem, and a number of his former prisoners followed it to its present grave on Mount Zion in the Catholic cemetery.
What a story. Now, you are somebody who nearly became a priest. I think you decided to leave the seminary just a few weeks or a few months before your scheduled ordination. And I'm wondering if Schindler's story, the story of both a scoundrel and a hero, has particular interest to you as someone who was in the seminary.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm always delighted with the idea of virtue emerging in unexpected people. The institution of the church pretends it can only emerge in really righteous people, in virtuous people, but it didn't in World War II. So I'm always perversely delighted to give one in the eye to the Vatican stooges who run the church in America and Australia. So on top of that, I felt that the Irish Australians in Australia in my childhood were in a position akin to that of the native Irish in Ulster. In the Australia of my childhood, before we were rescued by drafts of immigration from all over the world, Italy, Poland, Germany, before we had the waves of immigration, it was a very British place. And it mattered whether you were a Catholic or a Protestant. And so I think I can say that we felt discrimination in our childhoods. And as Spielberg pretended to be able to build the entire Brontosaurus out of a speck of DNA in the gut of a Stone Age mosquito captured in amber, so I, when I fell in love with the story, thought that my Irish Catholic Australian background was of some assistance in trying to work out the way, was a speck of DNA out of which I could work up the whole dinosaur of racial discrimination against Polish Jews. Now, this was a delusion, but it was a blessed delusion, and it empowered me. You know how lovers think they can do anything? Well, I fell in love with the story and I thought I could do anything. I was an innocent blundering into something that had huge reverberations for both the Gentile and Jewish community. And I wanted it to be a book for Gentiles and Jews. I wanted it to make a big impact on the Gentile community because I'm horrified by racism in Christendom. The ugly baboon backside of Christendom is racism. And I wanted to address that through the book.
Thomas Keneally is the author of Schindler's List. He's teaching this semester at the University of California at Irvine. This is Fresh Air.